The hero is commonly the simplest and obscurest of men. Again, the hero is commonly the simplest and obscurest of men. Henry David Thoreau. Who has ever heard of the likes like Arnold von Winkelried, Mark Nelson? Hopefully people in Stillwater know who that is. Or Norman Hines. Arnold von Winkelried, Mark Nelson, or Norman Hines. At least they will give you the incentives to stay awake till we get there. Beginning with Memorial Day, but all throughout the summer months, this great nation remembers those who had given their all, who had laid down their lives while serving and preserving this nation. The war with the most American casualties was fought on American soil. It was the Civil War, totaling approximately 650,000 deaths. The American Civil War is followed by World War II, which resulted in over 400,000 American deaths, and World War I with over 116,500 dead. The list of conflicts and casualties goes on, seemingly without end. The Vietnam conflict, oftentimes mistakenly referred to as the Vietnam War, it was never a declared war. That's what's so tragic about that. The Vietnam conflict, Korean War, Revolutionary War, the War of 1812, Mexican-American War, Iraq War, and even the ongoing Afghanistan of war and Operation Inherent Resolve. Like the saying goes, all gave some gave all. Each country or people has its larger-than-life heroes. And those heroes can be military or civilian. The same applies to this great state. When visiting the Gettysburg battlefield, I came across a substantial monument. You can't miss that one. It's probably one of the most predominant monuments in honor of the first Minnesota. Here's a synopsis of their willingness to give all. The first Minnesota at Gettysburg. And again, I mentioned that because the Battle of Gettysburg happened this month, just over 150 years ago. The first Minnesota performed one of the most critical actions of the battle during Longstreet's assault of July 2nd. Sickles' corps was falling back in disarray, and Longstreet's men were advancing to penetrate the center of the Union line, which had been dangerously thinned to prop up other sectors. General Hancock rode up to the 1st Minnesota, the only organized Union troops at hand, pointed at the advancing Confederates, and ordered them to take those colors. Their sacrificial charge against overwhelming odds halted the Confederate advance and bought time for the Union line to reform, forcing Lee into one last desperate gamble with Pickett's charge the next day. The survivors of the 1st Minnesota played a role in repulsing that charge as well. The regiment went through several commanders. You know, they're not serving for, they don't send their people up, now go. No, they obviously lead. No, the regiment went through several commanders and suffered grievous losses during the battle. It entered the field 420 strong, of whom 32 men, Company L, were serving as skirmishers, and 56 men, Company C, were detached on July 2nd. 50 men were killed, 173 were wounded, and one missing. Colonel William Colville led the men into action and was wounded during the 2nd of July charge. Captain Nathan Messick took over command only to be killed the next day during the repulse of Pickett's charge. He was briefly followed by Captain Wilson B. Farrell, who was also killed, and finally by Captain Henry C. Coates. Again, this defining battle was the one that changed the course of history of this great nation. This month, just over 150 years ago, these Minnesotans gave their all. We shall always remember, honor, and upheld those who sacrifice their own well-being for the well-being of others. And again, that obviously transcends military sacrifice. In Switzerland, we celebrate and revere especially two heroes. One will be more commonly known as William Tell, who stood up against aggression, and the second one is Arnold von Winkelried. Arnold von Winkelried. The incident with which the name is connected is, after the defeat of Tell, the best known and most popular in the early history of the Swiss Confederation, slightly preceding the U.S. by a couple hundred years. At a critical moment in the Great Battle of Sempach, when the Swiss had failed to break the serried, pressed, and crowded ranks, that's how they have that force in a forward movement, but you have very pressed man-to-man, that's the serried ranks, there's nothing that could fit in between. There can also be no change of heart, you're moving, or you get run over, in essence. But in pressed and crowded ranks of the Austrian knights, they're all in their outfit, 19 shining armor. So a man of Unterwalden, Arnold von Winkelried, gave his life by selflessly creating an opening, by in essence, taking the brunt of the defenses of the Austrian defense on himself, and then creating a human ramp, in essence. So that the Swiss Confederates were able to make decisive inroads and ultimately win the battle. In Switzerland, to this day, the name Winkelried is bestowed on those who selflessly serve or sacrifice themselves for the good of their community or country. Calling someone a Winkelried is one of the greatest honors one can bestow on a fellow Swiss. And Billy Ray Cyrus' song, "Some Gave All," aptly captures this sentiment. I knew a man called him Sandy Kane. Few folks ever even knew his name, but a hero, yes, he was. Or was he? Left a boy, came back a man. Still many just don't understand about the reasons that we are free. I can't forget the look on his eyes or the tears he cries as he said these words to me. All gave some and some gave all. And some stood through for the red, white, and blue. And some had to fall. And if we ever think of me, think of all your liberties and recall. Some gave all. Sandy Kane is no longer here, but his words are oh so dear as they echo throughout our land for all his friends who gave us all, who stood the ground and took the fall to help their fellow men. Love your country and live with pride, and don't forget those who died. America, can't you see? All gave some and some gave all, and some stood through the red, white, and blue, and some had to fall, and if you ever think of me, think of all your liberties and recall. Some gave all. And if you ever think of me, think of all your liberties and recall. Yes, recall. Some gave all, some gave all. Even though we and our loved ones should refrain from joining the armed forces or law enforcement agencies, we shall never criticize or condemn those who choose to serve the nation and communities in such a way. Sometimes spouses or close relatives of brethren commit their lives into such service, and they almost feel that they have to somehow justify that, or they're treated with silence when somebody said, so what does your spouse do? But this has no room in the Church of God. Again, even though we discourage our people We don't want to have blood on our hands, so to speak, to join the armed forces or law enforcement agencies. We are not about to criticize or treat with silence those or their families who do. My own father spent his entire professional life in the Swiss armed forces, and nobody in my and my brother's life instilled a deeper love for country than he did. And I think to a degree even that I serve, in one of my roles as the Swiss community leader, I think that could probably be traced back to that. Some of us might have lost a loved one or know of someone who gave all while serving in the armed forces or in law enforcement. But again, that can go beyond that, as we see in a moment. We owe them our deepest appreciation and utmost respect. Those who have been judged to be Minnesota's most heroic belong to an exclusive but almost anonymous club. Here we're shifting gears and look at some civilians who gave all. In 1904, steel tycoon and philanthropist Andrew Carnegie decided he also wanted to find and reward heroes, especially civilians who have risked or gave their lives to save others. He created the Carnegie Hero Fund Commission, and in the past 110 years, the organization has awarded heroism medals to almost 10,000 individuals in the United States and Canada. About 100 of those have been awarded to Minnesotans. The life-saving acts performed here include defending people from gunmen and attacking dogs, plucking toddlers from the path of oncoming trains, rescuing people endangered by cave-ins, poisonous gas and flooded ice caverns, and hauling people out of burning cars, planes, trucks, buses, and buildings. But not surprisingly, in the land of 10,000 lakes, or is it more like 18,000 lakes, the most common act performed by a hero in Minnesota is what? Maybe if one or the other one who can attest to that is saving someone from drowning. Nearly two-thirds of the Carnegie medals awarded here went to someone who plunged into icy waters, dove into submerged cars, or battled dangerous currents to rescue someone. And it's also above average that people actually die doing so. The average age of Minnesotan Carnegie Award recipients at the time they performed the rescue is 30. But heroes can be almost any age. No. Listen up, all young and young at heart. The youngest Carnegie Medal recipient in Minnesota was a 9-year-old Stillwater boy, Mark Nelson, who in 1911, slightly before our time, I would say, saved a 21-year-old woman twice his size from drowning. The oldest was a 77-year-old Norman Hines, who pulled a woman from the path of a freight train in 1999 when the woman's motorized car got stuck on the tracks. No, it's one of those carts where people, you know, handicaps, and it just kind of stalled out. It's a cart, not a car, I should say, motorized cart, and just kind of got stuck, just couldn't get going. And, of course, couldn't just kind of leap off and just take off. You know, she needed to be rescued in this condition. How about those teens? More than a third of heroes were teenagers. You know, you're never too young, as we see. Most of those who got the Carnegie Award in Minnesota are male. Women received about 12% of the awards made here, and it's higher than national average of about 9%. Otherwise, heroes come from all walks of life. Few, if any, are famous. The Carnegie Medal recipients in Minnesota include housewives, farmers, truck drivers, and businessmen. An accountant, a tax driver, a salesman, a fisherman, a brickmaker, a butter maker, a baker, a clergyman, a cook, a clerk, a congressman, and a convicted felon are all counted among Minnesota's Carnegie heroes. They're common people, said Carnegie Hero Fund Executive Director Walter Rukowski of the award recipients. But their acts are extreme. And as we are shifting gear here, now this is to keep in mind, it's not always one act of heroism. What we will see is a lifelong act of heroism in that way, knowing, being willing to lay down one's life. Again, similarly, do we recognize and honor those who selflessly serve or sacrifice themselves for the good of the family, community, the church, and for our Father's way of life? The title of today's message is Our Heroes in the Faith Who Gave It All. Our Heroes in the Faith Who Gave It All. May I suggest we ask ourselves, what can we learn from our heroes in the faith who gave it all? What can we learn from our heroes in the faith who gave it all? And we have countless examples, obviously, in the Bible. Please join me in exploring this question in the remaining minutes of this message. Our heroes in the faith who gave it all. As we explore the question of what selfless service means to us children of the Most High, let's turn to the book of Hebrews, chapter 11. Book of Hebrews, chapter 11. Who is or are our heroes? We just mentioned some heroes a moment ago. Who is or are our personal or family heroes? And sometimes the family rallies around somebody, maybe somebody in their past. As a matter of fact, my mother comes immediately to mind when thinking of a hero. Having lost our father when I was 17 years of age and my brother is 15 years of age, it has been our mother who has provided that much-needed glue to preserve the Merker family. She has been all in our family as evidenced, or I should say she has been all in that sense, you know, nothing holding back like a mother would do, as evidenced in setting a tremendous example of selfless service. And we all know individuals that we hold dear. It might not be one act of heroism, again, it might be just a lifetime, just, and even more important, a lifetime of heroism. As we reflect on our lives, as well as the lives of our loved ones, many an individual comes to mind who exhibited or is exhibiting selfless service to our families, our communities, and our local fellowship, as well as the larger Church of God community. And again, those can be the little things. It could be serving a camp. You know, we just had the preteen camps where the teens have an opportunity really to serve, selflessly serve, you know, the preteens. You know, to see, okay, you know, to come to realize, for at least for that brief moment in time, you know, the teens are not the most important thing, or the adults, or the minister, or the mother, or the father. No, the most important element or individual is our precious preteens. And it's wonderful to serve. And of course, on the flip side, to be gracious recipient of that service. And, you know, that's also part of that learning for our little ones, obviously, to always then graciously receive that and honor that. Again, who is or are our personal or family heroes? As we ponder this question, let's briefly remember the heroes listed in the book of Hebrews and looking at some of those qualities. And as we deal with a particular individual, what can we learn from that? Just from that short write-up, not even going back in time, but just to take that statement in Hebrews 11, to take a close look. And I would like us all to challenge each one of us, because each one can take something else from it. You know, it just give an impetus a little bit, food for thought. But I think it's great if we go through that, especially during this time from Pentecost to this wonderful future or the beginning of a new age, the age to come, the beginning of the millennium, as manifested or as depicted, I should say, by the Feast of Trumpets. It's good that we take some time. Our Father remembers his faithful and fallen servants, whoever they are. And he remembers us while we are alive, obviously. But in this case, his faithful and fallen servants. In said book and chapter, we find a list of some of the true heroes in the faith. They include some of his outstanding servants from the time of Abel to Enoch, and from Noah to the time of Abraham and Sarah. Tribute to Isaac, Jacob, Joseph, and Moses is also given. Let's start with Abel. Hebrews 11, verse 4. And I'm reading from the Amplified Version of the Bible. Hebrews 11, verse 4. By faith, Abel offered to God a more acceptable... Again, by faith, Abel offered to God a more acceptable sacrifice than Cain, through which it was testified of him that he was righteous, upright, in right standing with God. And God testified by accepting his gifts. And though he died, yet through this act of faith, he still speaks. Still speaks to us today, you know, as we speak about that. Do we have faith and are we faithful? You know, these are not usually seen as maybe characteristics of a true hero. But do we have faith and are we faithful? Do we serve our Father selflessly out of faith and out of being faithful? Not in a sense, okay, I serve better than this guy, he must love me more. What kind of offerings do we present to our Father? Key is that such offering is between our Father and us. Cain somehow believed that his unacceptable offering had something to do with Abel. It was his downfall. Somehow it was Abel's fault. Nothing could be further from the truth. Do we offer ourselves as living sacrifices? This is true heroism. How is our service when nobody is watching? Are we righteous in our selfless service? Or are we self-righteous in our selfish service? Again, are we righteous in our selfless service? Or are we self-righteous in our selfish service? Are we upright in right standing with our Father? If our service is based on our Father's righteousness, then we have the sure promise of Him accepting our gifts. Otherwise, it's just a waste. Not only that, our selfless, dedicated to our Father base is that service dedicated to our Father based on His righteousness? And if so, it will speak volumes of us. And we are a witness to others well after we have completed our race. No, people talk about it, good or bad. Everybody has a reputation, good or bad. What will people tell of us? Enoch, just briefly, and I just hit on them. That's why I encourage each one of us to go deeper into that and go back in time or read in Genesis and so forth of their example. But Enoch, continuing in Hebrews 11, verse 5, by faith that pleased God, Enoch was caught up and taken to heaven so that he would not have a glimpse of death, and he was not found because God had taken him. For even before he was taken, he received the testimony, still on record, that he had walked. Again, this is testimony, and it's still on record, not right now. that he had walked with God and pleased him. Does our faith and faithfulness please our Father? How is our walk with our Father? And that includes Jesus Christ as well. We better walk with our brother Jesus Christ. Do we strive to please him in all our thoughts and actions as Enoch and by extension Jesus Christ demonstrated? And also Jesus Christ, that's his example. In everything that he did, he pleased his Father. And nobody could do it the way Jesus Christ obviously did it. Does our life reflect the fact that we walk with our Father? And is such known to those we touch on a daily or periodic basis? Verse 6, but without faith it is impossible to walk with God and please him, for whoever comes near to God must necessarily believe that God exists and that he rewards those who earnestly and diligently seek him. And that he's a rewarder. It's two things right here. You know, do we believe that our Father and Jesus Christ to his right hand exist? And that our Father is a rewarder of those who earnestly and diligently seek him. Do we strive to draw near to our Father? That's the big lesson, by the way, of Daniel 11. And the entire story of Antiochus Epiphanes, as a precursor of the end time Antichrist. But if you want to summarize it up, not to digress here, it is, you know, do we draw close to our Father? This is, in essence, the lesson in a nutshell. If so, we must believe that he exists. Not in some kind of academic way, yeah, I know God exists, he's somewhere. No, do we, with every fiber, believe in our young ones and those on the way to baptism that our Father exists? And not only that, are we confident that he rewards those who earnestly and diligently seek him? And can we see that reward even in our current life, but ultimately, obviously, the fulfillment as we inherit the seed of glory? But that reward is now, not necessarily in some kind of material riches or this or that, but can we see, you know, that law, the love of God in our lives? And that he's rewarding us, that he strives and yearns to have that close relationship with us. Our Father rewards us in countless ways, even in this lifetime, even though oftentimes the life is rough and we encounter various trials. But then ultimately, as we will inherit the seed of glory upon our transition from dust to everlasting sonship in the kingdom of our Father, do we earnestly and diligently seek him? And Noah, verse 7, by faith, with confidence in God and his word, Noah, being warned by God about events not yet seen, in reverence, prepared, not dragging the feet. Do I really have to do that? You know, oh boy. Do you know what kind of a big project that is? No. In reverence, prepared an ark for the salvation of his family. So it boiled down. You know, by obeying God, you know, he saved his own. But this act of obedience, he condemned the world and became an heir of the righteousness which comes by faith. How is our confidence in our Father and his word, who became Jesus Christ 2 millennia ago? Our Father will warn us about events not yet seen. Don't have to speculate about this or that. Do we heed his warnings and in reverence take the required steps with unwavering resolve? Not with some kind of infighting in the Church of God community, no. Such is a matter of survival and the advent of a new beginning for us and our physical and spiritual family. In a world engulfed in rebellion and disobedience, do we become heirs of the righteousness which comes by faith and by being faithful? But how? Is it by taking society and its attitudes around us head on? Pointing out everything that is wrong? And again, that's kind of, I think, maybe a little bit in our human nature, obviously, that we do that. Is it by taking society and its attitudes around us head on? Point out everything that can go wrong? Again, it's the attitude of society and has a big effect on each one of us. Far from it. By obeying, we see it clearly, by obeying our Father and our brother Jesus Christ, we condemn the world. Not by verbally condemning this or that on Facebook or where else. By obeying our Father and our brother Jesus Christ, we condemn the world and at the same time become heirs of righteousness. And this is what we're looking forward to, the Feast of Trumpets, just ahead of us, short time ahead of us. What do we do with that time? Not just spending a beautiful time, figuratively speaking, of Minnesota summer here, but also what do we do to prepare ourselves to that? And again, it starts with obedience. Abraham, verse 8, by faith, Abraham, when he was called by God, obeyed by going, again, obeyed, you know, this is kind of a theme here, by going to a place which he was to receive as an inheritance. And he went, not knowing where he was going. By faith, he lived as a foreigner in the promised land, as in a strange land, living in tents, as nomads with Isaac and Jacob, who were fellow heirs of the same promise. For he was waiting expectantly and confidently, looking forward to the city which has foundations, an eternal heavenly city, whose architect and builder is God. And that's a reference to the new beginning as we celebrate on the eighth day. That's a very vital, important point that needs to be celebrated as well on so-called that last great day, that eighth day, is when that heavenly Jerusalem will come to the new heaven and new earth. He had that vision. Do we have that vision? Do we have the faith and faithfulness of Abraham, who, when he was called, obeyed? Probably the rest of the family thought he was nuts. Do we obey at once when our Father opens our eye to His will for us and our loved ones? Or are we the procrastinating kind? Are we willing to receive our inheritance? That's a serious question we have to ask ourselves as we journey from Pentecost to the Feast of Trumpets. Are we willing to receive our inheritance? Or do we find 100 excuses of why not, so that we have to go so-called proverbial 40-year detour in the wilderness? Key of such is that we live in a continuous state of repentance, you know, that we humbly walk with our Father. But ultimately, it is through our Father's chesed, His loving kindness and marvelous mercies, that He reconciled us to Himself through the atoning sacrifice of Jesus Christ. All we can contribute to that is to make it our own, to accept that in a humble mindset. Again, as we journey from Pentecost to the Feast of Trumpets. And if you think of this atoning sacrifice of Jesus Christ, you know, thinking back to the spring festival season, such sacrifice was perfect in every way and acceptable to our Father. Had our brother failed, he couldn't have blamed it on anybody, you know. But of course he did not fail. Our brother then was granted to take his seat at the right hand of our Father. And that was granted, you know, 10 days before Pentecost on the day of Ascension. And by bestowing on us His Holy Spirit, our Father made us co-heirs with none other than Jesus Christ. It's also very humbling to see how the Spring Festival and Pentecost are tied together, 50 days. It's the same harvest season, Jesus Christ being the first of the first, and we being the first fruits. Do we follow our Father and Jesus Christ to our destiny, the kingdom of God, our true promised land? What is our focus? Are we willing to live as foreigners in a strange land, living in temporary dwellings with our offspring? Maybe today it's not a tent, maybe it's a rental house, it could be a house that primarily is owned by the bank, temporary dwellings with our offspring, but ultimately in our body, obviously, this is a temporary dwelling place. Who are also fellow heirs of the same promise, do you know that? The second, third, fourth, fifth, whatever generation, you have that same promise. Parents don't have some kind of a unique promise apart from each of you. It's that same promise. You are fellow heirs of the same promise. If you choose that. We don't believe in universal salvation or just kind of a feel-good message of some sort. Yes, our young ones, our beloved children, you are the fellow heirs of our Father's promise alongside your parents. And that should be the message of every camp or everything, how precious each one of you are. Not because I say so, because our Father, through His Word, says so. Your promise, your inheritance, is in no way, shape, or form any inferior to your parents and, in some instances, grandparents. Are we, adults and youngsters alike, waiting expectantly and confidently, looking forward to the city which has foundations, that eternal city from above, the heavenly Jerusalem, whose architect and builder is our Father through and by His Word? Verse 17, by faith Abraham, when he was tested, that is, as the testing of his faith was still in progress, offered up Isaac, and he who had received the promises of God was ready to sacrifice his only son of promise. To whom it was said, through Isaac your descendants shall be called. What is our test in life? What is our test in life? Such test is oftentimes a progression. What is the most important element in our lives? What are we being asked to surrender, to offer up? It could be anything. It could be our health. It could be anything. What is more important to us than our Father or our brother, Jesus Christ? Verse 19, for he considered it reasonable to believe, now speaking of Abraham, that God was able to raise Isaac even from among the dead. Indeed, in the sense that he was prepared to sacrifice Isaac in obedience to God, Abraham did receive him back from the dead, figuratively speaking. Wow. Now that is faith and being faithful. That's why he's called the father of the faithful. It's another very good lesson. Study Abraham, his life, and then his wife Sarah. Verse 11, by faith even Sarah herself received the ability to conceive a child, even when she was long past the normal age for it, because she considered him who had given her the promise to be reliable and true to his word. So from one man, though he was physically as good as dead, were born as many descendants as the stars of heaven in number and innumerable as the sand on the seashore. So are we open to the humanly impossible? You know, our human reasoning gets oftentimes in the way. What's reasonable? Don't be unreasonable now. You know, we oftentimes say that. To expect, Abraham and Sarah, all his friends, when you would say, I think, you want to expect a child, so friends probably going to say, okay, now, don't be unreasonable. Are we open to the humanly impossible? Do we trust in our Father or intervene in our life even though outward and inward circumstances seem to be to the contrary? How real are our Father's promises to us and those entrusted to our care? Do we see our Father's promises to be reliable and true? Or do we limit our Father in our lives and in the lives of our loved ones? What's holding us back? If you look at our situations, whatever it is, what is holding us back? Are we open to the humanly impossible? If something is in accordance to our Father's will, then He can make it happen. No ifs or buts. So each one of them was guided and sustained by faith and by being faithful. That's true heroism, to stick it through regardless of the circumstances. It's not situational. And we all find ourselves in our various scenarios. Verse 13, all these died in faith, guided and sustained by it, without receiving the tangible fulfillment of God's promises, only having seen, anticipated them, and having welcomed them from a distance, and having acknowledged that they were strangers and exiles on the earth. Like each one of us, none of them received the tangible fulfillment of our Father's promise. Or promises. Again, like us, they had only anticipated them and having welcomed them from a distance. And at the same time, they have acknowledged that they were strangers and exiles on the earth. They never entangled themselves with society's activities and attitudes. But what were, are, and will they be looking for? What were and are and will they be looking for? Verse 14. Now those who say such things make it clear that they are looking for a country of their own. And if they had been thinking of that country from which they departed as their true home, they would have had a continuing opportunity to return. You know, to play it safe somehow. Play it safe, you know, being one foot over here. But the truth is that they were longing for a better country. That is, a heavenly one. For that reason, God is not ashamed. For that reason, God is not ashamed of them or to be called their God, even to be surnamed their God, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. For He has prepared a city for them. Are we willing to burn our boats that could tempt us to return to our former lives? In 1519, Captain Hernan Cortes landed in Veracruz to begin his great conquest. Upon arriving, he gave the order to his men to burn the ships. Here's the lesson. Retreat is easy when we have the option. Ask any Frenchman. We all cling to something that acts as our escape hatch and our exit strategy in a negative connotation. What Cortes did was force himself and his men to either succeed or die. Retreat was not an option. The question we have to ask ourselves is this: what are my ships? What am I afraid to let go of? We cannot answer that question for each other. Because it's very obvious, you know, when you say, oh, this person is held back by this, you know, from a distance. We don't see what's holding us back. That's our trouble. Again, we cannot answer that question for each other. Let's ponder the question. What chips do I need to burn in my life? speaking the group of Scandinavians, and we never think of that. What do you mean? I mean, burning our ship. But here Cortes did. Let's take a look at them. What those elements are in our lives. As we consider each one, again, it's a homework assignment for each one of us. You know, what are the ships we need to burn? What are those ships I need to burn in my own life? What is our focus on in life? What do we long for? Do we long for a better country that is a heavenly one? If so, our Father is not ashamed of us to be called our God. And our brother is not ashamed of us to be called our brother. For they have prepared a city for us, the New Jerusalem, which is from above. And it is our calling as first fruits to help them with that task of bringing many sons and daughters to glory, that many will be able to enter that New Jerusalem. Isaac, let's talk about Isaac, Jacob and Joseph quickly. Verse 20, by faith Isaac blessed Jacob and Esau, believing in what God revealed to him, even regarding things to come. Do we believe what our Father guides us in our lives and in the lives of our loved ones, that He guides us? Do we see the hand of our Father in our lives? Or do we consider ourselves to be poor, abandoned orphans? Jacob, verse 21, by faith Jacob, as he was dying, blessed each of the sons of Joseph and bowed in worship, leaning on the top of his staff. Again, do we believe that our Father guides us? You know, you could see that Joseph quickly said, no, Father, your hands are turned around. You know, it's, no, you don't know, because he barely could see. No, God was guiding him. Do we believe in that? Again, in the lives of those, you know, when he blessed, you know, Ephraim and Manasseh, you know, he says, oh, Joseph said, no, it's a mistake here. No, ultimately, and obviously, you know, each one have to come to that point, you know, do we believe that God is guiding us in our lives? Joseph. By faith, Joseph, when he was dying, referred to the promises of God for the exodus of the sons of Israel from Egypt and gave instructions concerning the burial of his bones in the land of the promise. Joseph well knew that God would eventually lead his people out of Egypt. You know, in essence, he is the one who got them there. Interesting lessons right there too. Joseph well knew that God would eventually lead his people out of Egypt. Thus he gave specific instructions concerning the burial of his bones in the land of the promise. Because he had that vision of that land. You know, how is it with each one of us? What is our vision of the future? As we prepare and then ultimately travel to the various feast sites, hopefully we don't just see this or that destination as the destination in itself. No, we follow a vision in symbolicity of a larger vision. Moses' parents. Verse 23, by faith Moses after his birth was hidden for 3 months by his parents because they saw he was a beautiful and divinely favored child. And they were not afraid. Here's the interesting part. And they were not afraid of the king Pharaoh's decree. And they were not afraid of the king Pharaoh's decree. They didn't just obey Pharaoh just to surrender their son or kill him or anybody else for that purpose in their family. Moses' parents engaged in civil disobedience as they saw that he was a beautiful and divinely favored child. And it was recorded for our benefit. Sometimes one hears that or that comment about this topic, but it's very clear there's a place of time for that. Are we willing to choose life over death, ultimately? That's what it is. And are we willing to protect that what has been entrusted to us by our Father. It's a challenge to all mothers and fathers. We never know what the future will hold. Are we afraid of the prevailing governmental and/or cultural edicts, laws, and stipulations so that we surrender to them? Or do we follow the example of Moses' parents who were fearless in the face of severe adversity which demanded the death of their child? What kind of parents are we? Are we parents of action? Moses. That would have never happened. The story would be over right there. No Moses. By faith, Moses, verse 24, when he had grown up, refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter. Some mature earlier than others. Some come to their senses earlier than others. Verse 25, because he preferred to endure the hardship of the people of God rather than to enjoy the passing pleasures of sin. But society has so much nicer things to offer. Now that is a true sign of maturity, as we see here in verse 25. Because he preferred to endure the hardship of the people of God rather than to enjoy the passing pleasures of sin. Do we choose to walk in our Father's way, or do we prefer the passing pleasures of sin? That's kind of the lesson of the prodigal son. But of course, the older brother in that parable never learned that. He probably had to do some learning in another way. The passing pleasures of sin are highly enticing. Entire marketing departments are built around that. Let's not sugarcoat anything here. The on-demand nature of society holds a death grip on each one of us. Each one of us. But especially our young ones. The future of the church. From a carnal perspective, let's face it, from a carnal perspective, who wouldn't rather go watch a movie or play some video games than having to listen to this Swiss guy expound on the Word of God? How was the young adult Moses able to prefer the hardship of the people of God? Verse 26, he considered the reproach of the Christ, that is, the rebuke he would suffer for his faithful obedience to God, to be greater wealth than all the treasures of Egypt. For he looked ahead to the reward promised by God. Again, it's that reward, it's that theme, to really see something beyond our physical existence. Moses considered it to be greater wealth than all the treasures of Egypt. How? For he looked ahead to the reward promised by God. As we go to the feast sites, do we look ahead, or do we celebrate with our fellow brethren that time when we will have received as first fruits that reward already? And then, at the same time, the lesson of the feast is then to help mankind, those who make it through the millennium, and then at the very end, through the white throne judgment period, to get there as well. To instill that vision of that reward promised by God. Now, that is our challenge when serving our young ones, obviously. How do we look ahead to the reward, which is our transformation from dust to everlasting glory at our brother Jesus Christ's return to this earth? This reward entails being part of a better resurrection. Not that that should be an incentive to become part of first fruits. This reward entails being part of a better resurrection. Sometimes one hears the story, or in the worst case among the young ones or anybody, oh well, I might just take the train 1,000 years later. Now if I miss the first one. Very dangerous game, no? These are not the same, those resurrections. We don't know much about those who, after they have gone through the white throne judgment, they were glorified, yes, but we don't know exactly how. This reward entails being part of a better resurrection, as the very children of the Most High, serving alongside with Jesus Christ as fellow priests into all eternity. That's also a lesson of atonement, by the way, as we join Jesus Christ as fellow priests in serving the people. Verse 27. By faith he left Egypt, being unafraid of the wrath of the king, for he endured, again, he's not afraid of the wrath of the king. He has inherited that from his parents. Huh? They were not afraid of the wrath of the king. By faith he left Egypt, being unafraid of the wrath of the king, for he endured steadfastly as seeing him who is unseen. Do we see him who is unseen? After all, Moses spent 40 long years in the wilderness forsaking all the treasures of Egypt. Can you imagine how tough it is? Here you are a top general and have all the privileges growing up in Pharaoh, and then you're just kind of meandered for 40 years. No? You know, when the Israelites did that, after that, you know, it's almost like Moses been there, done that, you know, for 40 years being in the desert. By faith, he kept the Passover and the sprinkling of the blood on the doorposts so that the destroyer of the firstborn would not touch them, the firstborn of Israel. And we are the firstborn of God today. There was no historical precedent to this, you know, at that time. It's completely by faith. You know, what do you expect me to do, you know, Moses? No, this was truly an example of walking by faith. And now for the second hour, just kidding. Just kidding, everybody's burning up in their seats. And also I would encourage to look at the people of Israel, how they looked at it, and how they attested here, what's written about them as we continue. Rahab, also, it's very interesting. We hear all this speculation about how could a prostitute, about this or that, how could he ever consider her to list her here. But maybe that's one thing that we should take a quick look at. Verse 31, as we slowly wrap up. By faith, Rahab, the prostitute, it's interesting that he felt compelled, the writer here, to make clear that there's no misunderstanding. We don't sugarcoat anything in life. And as we have seen through the example of David and probably through our examples in the future, that's kind of a scary thought, you know, that you know, maybe there's a certain name attached to each one of us in that way. By faith, Rahab the prostitute was not destroyed along with those who were disobedient because why? Because she had welcomed the spies sent by the sons of Israel in peace. End of story. No, God has chosen to list her among the righteous in that, among heroes in the faith. Because she had welcomed the spies sent by the sons of Israel in peace. And again, it continues in verse 32, what more shall I say? Know how people have experienced. And again, I encourage each one of us to go through that on our own. Let's turn to the final passage as we wrap up this message in John chapter 5. Also, he refers, and I'm just referring to Hebrews 11, but as we're turning to John chapter 5, in Hebrews 11 also we learn, our Father shows that the present world is not worthy of the ultimate sacrifice made by so many of his faithful servants. You know, in verse 38, if you want to jot that down, in Hebrews 11, people of whom the world was not worthy. And that's what it is. It's not like we have anything against this world or this. It's just it's the other way around. You know, the world is not worthy of the true servants of God, of the true heroes in the faith. Final passage in John chapter 5. Speaking of the significance of the next holiday, the first of the fall holidays, and we have alluded to that a few times, Jesus Christ encourages and warns us with the following words. It's always interesting, you know, in Jesus Christ or throughout Scripture, it's an encouragement but a warning at the same time. That's perfect communication right there. John 5, verse 25 through 29. I assure you that most solemnly say to you, A time is coming and is now when the dead will hear the voice of the Son of God, and those who hear it will live. Verse 26, for just as the Father has life in himself and is self-existent, even so he has given to the Son to have life in himself and be self-existent. And he has given him authority to execute judgment because he is the Son of Man, sinless, qualifying him to sit in judgment over mankind. Do not be surprised at this, for a time is coming when all those who are in the tombs will hear his voice. And they will come out, those who did good things will come out to a resurrection of life. You know, that's what we see as the resurrection taking place at the Feast of Trumpets. But those who did evil things will come out to a resurrection of judgment, as we see the white throne judgment period at the end of when the entire 7,000 years are completed. May our Father speed that day. All I can conclude is with this. I want to be counted amongst the heroes in the faith who gave it all. How about you, whether baptized or on the way to baptism, or preparing to be baptized? Amen.